From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. On an all-books edition of the show, we meet Milwaukee native Julie Tarney, whose new book shares her journey as the parent of a transgender child and the positive example she hopes it will set.
Later, YouTube star Grace Helbig explains how her quirky video style developed.
The only thing you can do online is be yourself, and I'm lucky to have a lot of friends and loved ones close to me that are just genuine people and authentically themselves all the time.
And the cowboy at the center of Milwaukee writer Larry Watson's latest novel doesn't think of himself in iconic terms, a trait Watson remembers in his grandfather.
He didn't think of his cowboy years as the high point of his life. He thought he was a success when he homesteaded, raised a family, helped start a community, a church, a school.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We're listening back to some of our most thought-provoking book interviews of 2016 today.
This year, actor Jeffrey Tambor made headlines for his Emmy speech in which he urged Hollywood to hire more transgender actors. Tambor won the award for his role as a transgender woman in the Amazon series Transparent. The show is part of a growing cultural conversation about gender identity and what it means to be trans or gender nonconforming. But until recently, concepts of gender diversity and identity were relatively unheard of.
Author Julie Tarney is a Milwaukee native, and in 1992, her two-year-old son, Harry, made a loaded statement, "Inside my head, I'm a girl." At the time, it was pretty uncharted territory, and there weren't many resources for parents in her situation. That's part of what inspired Tarney to write her recent book, My Son Wears Heels, which discusses the trials and tribulations of raising a gender-diverse child without a guidebook.
Tarney spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and she began by explaining why she decided to share the story.
I wrote this book for a reason. First of all, I think I'm in a unique position because I have lived with a gender-diverse child from toddler to adulthood. And from all I've learned in this journey with Harry, and the more I continue to learn, his outcome is not as common as it should be. His good experience and having parents who were willing to go on that journey with him is not nearly as common as it should be. So I realized that I could be a voice for other LGBTQ kids. I know that my story may help other parents. And bottom line, I think I want those parents to know that they're not alone, that if they have a child who's expressing in a way that is not what they would expect from a boy or girl child, meaning they don't fit into society's fairly strict gender expectations, that my book could help assure them that they weren't going to be on that journey totally alone.
And that's something that you actually looked for. You talk about it in the book, trying to find other examples of kids who are gender diverse, how to deal with those kinds of issues, those questions. And you came up with really nothing.
I mean, you have to remember that Harry was very young. He was always a vocal child, but he was 2 years old when he told me, "Inside my head, I'm a girl." And there were very few resources. There was a lot of misinformation, a lot of stereotyping, little knowledge. And words didn't exist. The language was very inadequate then. There were no terms like gender nonconforming or gender expansive, gender fluid, even transgender. Maybe it was being used in the medical community, but I'd never heard it. I don't think I heard transgender until even maybe Harry was in college. So, yeah, there weren't a lot of resources back then.
I mean, one of the things that you talk about, which, speaking as someone who's the same age as Harry, I never would have actually thought of, but you, of course, had a friend who Harry is in part named after, who passed away from complications with AIDS. And one of your fears when he starts asking these gender questions is that he'll have the same kind of life experience that your friend did.
I think because I didn't understand the difference between gender identity and sexual orientation, I was completely misunderstanding what Harry was trying to tell me. you know, that's what was so confusing for me was, okay, if Harry's saying inside his head he's a girl, does that mean that he's going to be gay? And it wasn't about sexual orientation at all. It was about gender identity. That is, who you know yourself to be inside. The woman who wrote the foreword to my book put it really well, Diane Arensaf. Gender identity is who you go to bed as, and sexual orientation is about who you go to bed with. So my confusion about what Harry was trying to tell me, I just was imagining, okay, there's a chance that Harry's going to be gay as a result of what he's just told me. I'm not sure. But my experience, my most recent experience with someone very close to me being gay was someone who had contracted AIDS. And, you know, here I was projecting this horrible future on a two-year-old. It was crazy and a little ridiculous when I think about it now. So how I dealt with that was to try and remember, and Harry's dad was really good at this, by trying to help me put things in perspective, was, you know, he's 2 years old. He's a kid. And so I just kept trying to bring myself back to the present moment, which is so important. You know, we want to protect our child. We want them to be safe. We want them to be happy. And when you're not sure what your child is expressing to you, and your experience has been something that, you know, was unpleasant, then you tend to think of the worst. You know, I would try and pivot in my mind that I want Harry to have a wonderful life and be a happy kid and feel safe and secure and confident with himself. My question always to myself was, how is what I'm going to say or do affect Harry? How will he interpret what I say or do?
One of the things that I think you negotiated really well, or you described very well in the book, you know, Harry was two. Harry was a very young kid. He's asking these questions very nonchalantly, very, you know, spur of the moment. And to kind of process that while not making a judgment or making those kind of snap comments that you might be inclined to, that takes a lot of effort. You know, I'm sure that that in and of itself causes a lot of anxiety.
There was definitely some stress related to the questions. I think that night before bed when Harry was two and he asked me, his question was, how do you know I'm a boy? And that question came really out of left field for me. But then I thought, you know, kids are two, and he had been running through the sprinkler with his neighborhood friends. And I thought, well, he's noticed there's differences in kids. And so when I explained to him, I gave him an anatomy lesson, and he seemed to understand that. But I could tell that there was something that he was still processing. And so when I probed a little bit more and told them I thought it was an interesting question and what made him think of it, that's when he told me inside my head, I'm a girl. And honestly, I had no idea how to respond to that. I was folding laundry at the time and was sitting on the floor of his room and just needed stall time. Like, how do I answer? This kid is looking at me with these big eyes and has just expressed his innermost self to me. And As I stood up, I rifled through every article I'd ever read about being a parent and what to expect from your kid. And I was just coming up with nothing. And again, going back to how do I assure this kid that they are perfect just the way they are? What I told Harry was that it's really great that you know that about yourself. And it was the right answer, because I got this big grin from him and he kind of rocked back on his feet. And he doesn't remember asking me that question. He doesn't remember the conversation at all. And when we talk about it now, he thinks that what he was really expressing was that he was drawn to things that were considered feminine. He knew that he liked Barbie dolls. He knew that he liked the color pink. And what he had been learning just in his interactions with other boys and girls in the neighborhood was, well, some of these things are considered girl toys and other things are considered boy toys. And I used to think, well, maybe Harry was just confused. But I realized that Harry was never confused. or maybe he was later as a teenager, and you know, as we all are trying to figure out who we are. But I think at the time he was just speaking his truth and what he knew about himself at the time. And it was really I who was confused, not Harry.
As we've been talking about, there is this larger conversation about gender nonconforming people and teens and gender diversity. Where do you see your book fitting into that wider conversation?
I want it to be a resource for parents who may be experiencing some of the same things that I did. I mean, I had the experience decades ago, and I know there are thousands of other parents who are learning about gender identity and struggling with what gender identity means for their child. So I'm hopeful that it can become part of the community and support and resources and expertise and research that exists today. And I wanted to add to the growing expanse of information that's available for parents today.
How did Harry feel when you told him you were going to write this book?
Well, I never told Harry that I was going to write the book. I told him that I had this idea of writing a book, that a friend of mine who's a PhD in psychology and works with LGBTQ youth and their families in Chicago thought that sharing my stories might be able to help other people. And by helping other parents, that you can help their kids. And so I asked Harry for permission to write the book. And I explained to him that it was my story, but that it certainly was my story as it related to being his parent. And he gave me permission. He said he thought that that was a good thing to do. I did ask him to read it before I sent it, you know, for any kind of final approvals from the publisher, my editor. And Harry really didn't have any problems with it. He gave me some good notes. I felt like actually I was talking to my editor, but he didn't really object to anything that I had written.
Did writing this ever feel invasive for you? You know, you share a lot of your inner feelings. You also share a lot about your life growing up. Did it ever feel like maybe this is too much?
Oh, gosh, Joy, it felt like that all the time. I mean, I think when I first had the idea of writing these stories, I was thinking about them more anecdotally, you know, the funny things or the interesting things or how I learned from Harry. And when I talked to a friend of mine who's a writer and who actually helped me develop the ideas for the book, she said, you know, unless you're David Sedaris or Chelsea Handler, no one's really going to be interested in your stories, your anecdotes. That if you're writing a memoir, it really has to be about you. You can't write Harry's story. It has to be your story. And I remember feeling this wave of anxiety about that, you know, putting myself out there and sharing my innermost thoughts and fears and worries and confusion wasn't necessarily an easy thing for me. There were times when I thought, can I really do this? Do I really want to do this? Especially when it came to sharing aspects of my childhood and my relationship with my parents. I had a difficult relationship with them, and they're no longer living. And since being an adult, I have reconciled my relationship with them and understand them to not have had perhaps the best resources available to them to be the kind of parent that I would have wanted. So for me, that writing this book and having to go back and look at the fears I had about being a parent and not wanting to be the kind of mother that my mother had been meant really, you know, digging that up again in my own mind. But it was really important to the telling of the story. So, yeah, I did. It wasn't the easiest thing for me or the most comfortable thing for me. But I know that it was important to put my story into the context of what the stakes were for me as a mom.
What was it like looking back and analyzing the decisions you made as a mother? There was a lot of, in the book, this kind of back and forth questioning of, you know, should I let Harry wear this? Was I wrong to not let him wear this? When you looked back at the decisions that you made, how did you feel about them?
Guilty. I had guilt. In fact, I think I asked Harry, you know, was there any permanent scarring? Did you feel any emotional damage now that you're grown? And he said no, that he felt like I had made up for those things. And Harry wasn't really viewing my redirecting him in certain ways or, you know, when I didn't want him to wear dress-up clothes outside of the house or to school. He was viewing my decision based on what he believed was society's rules, not necessarily how I would have wanted it to be, which I think is pretty astute for a kid, realizing that, well, okay, things are okay at home, but maybe not so much outside of the house, and that he determined that to be because that's how the outside world is, not how things are in my family.
If you were to go back and do things over, do you think you'd change anything?
Absolutely. I would just let Harry be Harry, and I wouldn't try and put anything on him or try and stifle his creativity or his self-exploration. You know, what difference does it make what color a kid wears or what toy a child plays with? You know, I think ideally we want to be raising whole people. We want those traits or characteristics that have been considered feminine to be viewed as a human characteristic. You know, sensitivity and nurturing should be something that every child has. So I would want Harry to just be able to express. And I think that's really what it was that I learned from Harry, aside from what gender identity is, what gender expression is. And I've come to think of it like handedness. You know, it's just who we are, our gender identity, our gender expression. It's we're either right-handed or left-handed, and that's who we are.
Well, Julie Tarney, thank you so much for sharing so much of yourself with us.
Oh, Joy, I appreciate so much you inviting me to come on today.
Julie Tarney is the author of My Son Wears Heels, One Mom's Journey from Clueless to Kick-Ass. She was in town earlier this year for an event at Boswell Book Company, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
Keep listening. Coming up next, an interview with Grace Helbig, YouTube sensation and author of a new book on pretending you have it. What is it? Well, we'll find out when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. You might know Grace Helbig from her YouTube channel called It's Grace. It has over 3 million subscribers to her brand of comedy meets satire meets social commentary.
Grace Helbig is also the author of two books, the latest which was out this year. Grace and Style, The Art of Pretending You Have It, includes features like The Art of Not Being Naked, The Art of the Body Tarp, The Art of Expanding Your Wardrobe Without Social Interaction, and, well, you get the idea.
Helbig made plenty of pithy comments when she appeared in Milwaukee earlier this year. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski reached her by phone as her tour began, and Helbig shared the backstory of her latest book.
I wrote the first book because I was really fascinated by self-help and that whole genre of literature. And I wrote this book because I'm also very fascinated by fashion and beauty. And I watch a lot of beauty gurus on YouTube. I read a lot of fashion magazines. And there's a very sort of pattern in the perspective that's out there. And so I wanted to write something that presented sort of an alternative viewpoint on beauty and fashion and all of that world.
Right. And in the front of the book, you have, "This book is dedicated to insecurity and fear, to my best friends and closest enemies." And I think a lot of people can relate to this, whether they are, you know, consider themselves fashion sense or not.
Mm-hmm.
And you also introduce the book by plainly stating how your eating disorder started during your last year of high school. So why was this important for you to do, to just start the book right off the bat with insecurities and eating disorders and saying, you know, fashion sense may present this one world, but here's what it's like for me?
It was really important for me because I kept hitting this wall, this block, when I was trying to figure out how to approach the idea of beauty in a funny way, because beauty and body image and self-image are all very personal topics for everyone. It's all dependent on the way you see yourself. And I couldn't make jokes about it until I really presented kind of my, quote, journey through the world of beauty and self-image and body image and all of that, just so the reader can really contextualize and understand where I'm coming from when I make fun of something or something sounds so arbitrary, is because comedy has become a huge therapy for me in the world of, you know, self-image. And so I thought it was really important because when I was younger, when I was 16, 17, 18, which is, you know, the primary age of a lot of my viewers on YouTube and people that kind of follow any of the work I do, I really wanted that strong, funny, confident female voice to say that you don't have to be sexy if you don't want to. You don't have to dress this way or look at yourself this way if you don't want to. And so if anyone that reads this book gets some reassurance from that, then I feel like it was worth it.
How is your relationship with your body image, confidence, how you look, how has that changed as you've grown in popularity over the internet? Because, you know, you can start as one person posting YouTube, but now that you've gained a following and you're on multiple platforms of promoting yourself and your work, how do you view things now?
I try to be as silly and loose about things as possible. It's kind of difficult. I've spent the last 7 years editing videos of my own face and body, so you get to learn a lot about yourself very specifically over a period of time. And the great thing is that when I got out of college and I started performing comedy and being around people that had a very open-minded and silly point of view, it really helped kind of free up these constraints that I kept putting around myself and helped me kind of explore other things that made me really happy. And it's grown over the course of, you know, creation online. And so I think now I feel like I know who I am. I feel way more confident. I'm also 30 years old now, which I think attributes itself to feeling slightly like you give less care to the insecurity and fear that came from caring so much about your appearance when you're younger. So, yeah, but I mean, we're all humans, but you have moments where you feel, you know, not so great. You have moments where you feel really great. And you have moments where you just want to wear a onesie out and not care.
Yeah. Do you think you had to wait till you're a bit older to approach and write a book like this?
Yeah, I really honestly didn't think that I would be writing about this in this book. And it's always kind of been in the back of my brain of when am I going to actually talk about this, if I would ever actually talk about body image, because I pride myself on putting comedy first in a lot of the content that I create. And I've had every opportunity over the last 7 years to put this in a video, to talk about it, you know, directly to the audience. And it just hasn't felt right. Something about writing it down in a book and really being able to craft how it sounded and see how it looked on a page felt right. And it felt more personal and intimate. It felt slightly more conversational than putting it up on the internet for people to listen to.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your book when you were going through your eating disorder and struggling with self-image that you read other people's depictions of their struggles, and that helped you so much. So in your mind, even though you've gained such popularity on the YouTube and internet platform, that there will always be a place for books?
Absolutely. I think books are so important. Books are so great because they're this tangible, physical piece of content that you can carry around with you and take places. And it's also something my parents actually understand, which is very different from the rest of the things that I create. So it's something, you know, really, really personal. And that's what I love about it. And that's truly what helped me. I didn't have the internet at my fingertips when I was going through all of this. I didn't have, you know, an excess of videos of people confessing everything that they've gone through. And so you really only had what you could find in books, and that was really helpful and wonderful for me. So I'm really happy to possibly provide that same situation for someone else.
The style and layout of the book is really nice, and I enjoy it, and kind of the silly, kind of funny fashion pictures, particularly the Flashdance hairspray and the ring pop in the front. I love those two components
Thank
in particular.
You.
And you also have great advice from your mom put in there. There's these sweatpants diaries of sweatpants going to the Mall of America, you know, for the Ultimate Academy. And, you know, the picture styles and the juxtaposing quotes from style icons and fashion icons compared to you and how you view things. So how did you choose what to include in the style guide? Imagine it took a long time to really narrow down what you thought was essential.
It did. I kind of, you know, I got halfway through creating it, and then I scrapped everything because the writing felt a little stilted. It didn't feel inspired. It felt a lot like it mimicked the first book and wasn't unique and special on its own. So I started over, and then my editor, Lauren, at Simon & Schuster was an amazing mentor in really kind of provoking me to think outside the box in fashion. And this didn't have to be just a do this and don't do this kind of guidebook. It could be whatever I wanted it to be. And that's where the idea for writing these sweatpant diaries as these like short kind of palette cleanser narrative pieces came in, and then getting quotes from other, you know, high-end designers and kind of mocking them in a way came in. And it really helped create this more like a skewed vision board of beauty and style that I loved way more than what I had been writing before. And, you know, if I had two more, three more years with it, it would probably be even better. But I'm really, really so excited with how it turned out.
Well, that's great. You know, your YouTube platform has created other opportunities, such as, you know, projects like Camp Dakota with other YouTubers mm-hmm. such as Hannah and Mamrie Hart, and to also promote books. And now you're even on a different platform with a show for the Entertainment Network. And what aspects of the YouTube culture and business model have you found useful or, you know, taken advantage of? Because it's really just probably in the past few years has really become a business model compared to a place for people to go and express their opinions.
It is. It is. It's as much marketing as it is content creation on YouTube. And that's what makes it so interesting. And that's why it's constantly evolving. The thing that I love the most about it, because I started in the world of auditioning for TV, film, and movies, is that it's a community based on collaboration rather than competition. The traditional space, you go to auditions and you're basically pitted against, you know, your peers for the opportunity to win a part. And online, there are no gatekeepers. You can promote whatever you want. You can talk about whatever you want. You can create a brand for yourself however you want. And when you find some of my closest friends have been made because of the YouTube space, finding like-minded individuals with similar senses of humor and supporting each other, because there's a underlying kind of thought that high tides raise all ships in the YouTube community. And it's really true. And I think it really allows all of us content creators to feel kind of bonded in this way and supported in this way. It feels like such a positive community. When I first graduated college, I got into the comedy improv community. And it was such a wonderfully positive community founded on the principle of yes and. And so everyone was so supportive. And when I started doing YouTube and got involved in that space, I noticed patterns that were similar to the improv community and things that I really, really loved about it because of that. And I think that's kind of the greatest quality of it.
So do you think you'll always have some sort of presence on YouTube, no matter what kind of other projects you pursue in the future?
I do. I love YouTube. I mean, I consume as much YouTube as I create. So I think at this point, it would be like a punishment for myself to not allow myself to exist on the platform. And also, I just love it. And it's so convenient. It's really great.
Yeah. How do you now manage the relationship of being a YouTube host and still connecting with your viewers now that the numbers of those viewers have grown so much and you're doing a book and other platforms? How do you stay connected with the people who were there from the beginning, or even the new fans that are coming on and viewing your videos and subscribing?
It's interesting because there's a moment of kind of panic and embarrassment if someone comes up to me in public and knows who I am and I don't know them because they watch my videos. Mm-hmm. There's still, because I make them from home or I make them from hotel rooms when I'm traveling, there's still this private kind of personal relationship I have with making videos that sometimes allows me to forget that other people have access to them. My parents, I don't call home as often as I should. And when I talked to my mom recently, she was like, "Oh yeah, how's the DIY going?" And I was like, "What?" She's like, "Yeah, you went to Michael's and bought like a ton of stuff." And I was like, "How'd you know that?" And she's like, "You put it online in a video." And I was like, "How did you? Oh, right. You can watch those videos. That's right." So it's always very strange. And so I think having that sort of mentality allows me to stay myself because I'm not overwhelmed by imagining too often the amount of people that might be seeing a video. And that's really kind of the only thing you can do online is be yourself. And I'm lucky to have a lot of friends and loved ones close to me that are just genuine people and authentically themselves all the time and have wonderful, caring, compassionate, hilarious personalities. And it really, you know, helps me stay grounded in a way, and also helps me have opportunities to do what I do. Hannah Hart and Mamrie Hart are two of my best friends, and they're two of the funniest, most genuine people you could meet. And so I think they really inspire me to stay true to myself and also to work hard and keep doing what we're doing and see what happens next.
Yeah, and with all of your hard work, you've been able to become, you know, a personality that, is able to be invited to red carpet events. And I found your little last section in your book interesting, you know, that here's a style guide, and then you find yourself in a situation that actually calls for, like, oh, okay, this is where fashion stuff happens, you know, and you, and you go in and you're photographed and overwhelmed in hair and makeup, and you kind of describe yourself as a curious introvert, and you go to the red carpet event and you're kind of completely overwhelmed and then maybe just want to go back home and go in a onesie and call it a night. Does that kind of also reinforce the style guide you made and, you know, finding value and being able to observe fashion in a, an appreciative way? And yet, okay, I'm ready to put on sweats right now.
Yeah. I mean, red carpet, I don't think I'll ever be 100% excited or 100% comfortable at a red carpet event. Mm-hmm. They're always the most bizarre playground. It's like being in this rainforest sort of like microcosm Hunger Games thing. It's really a weird experience, and a lot of, there's just a lot of wants happening from a lot of people all at the same time, and it's just kind of overlapping each other. And so it's fun to be a fly on the wall at those sort of things. That's really fun to just sort of observe all of, you know, the human behavior that's happening. But it is also fun to see it from the side of beauty, because there's such attention to detail and such hard work that goes in to creating this look on a person so that this photo for one moment in time turns out okay. And it's really hilarious if you step back from it for a second and you realize that one human had probably four other humans polishing and buffing and painting their body in some way and giving them clothing so that they, when they stood in front of all of these strangers screaming at them with cameras to take their photo, they looked attractive to a bunch of other strangers that lived off in other parts of the world that saw that photo that they've never met before. It's really such a bizarre experience. Mm. And it's also, when you go to them in real life, they're so much smaller than they seem on TV or online in photos. And that's always interesting, too, to see the behind-the-scenes aspects that you don't see in the red carpet photos. And that's always kind of fun, too.
So you're always needed to be presentable in some sort of way. But what has remained your favorite outfit or type of clothes to wear?
My favorite outfit or type of clothes to wear? I think pretty generically, just like jeans and a T-shirt are pretty, you know, good for me. And something that's my go-to. I'm like looking in my suitcase right now, wondering what I should wear tonight, trying to find a T-shirt that's the least amount wrinkled. I think I also have gotten really into like ironing on letters to make my own shirts, which have been really fun. And I've gotten a lot of questions as to where I've bought shirts because I've made them myself. Mm-hmm. So that's a great quick tip for anyone that's traveling and needs multiple outfits. Just bring some iron-on letters with you and iron them in your hotel room. It's really great. But yeah, I think anything pretty basic that way. Just some jeans and a T-shirt.
Yeah, I'm along those same lines. And as a self-described the category of backpack that you had in this, and as someone who needed to re-pierce her ear last summer at my sister's wedding because it had been that long before since I wore an earring. So my sister had a parent trap, one ear, just one of them. But
oh my God.
I still found this book enjoyable because for me, it's just I'm over 6 feet. So it's really hard for me to find clothes. And I've grown to just not like shopping at all.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, just some of the things that you include in here are really nice and funny and, you know, kind of giving me ideas on how to be a little more open to going away from just what fits, you know, and what looks
Thanks.
Presentable.
Yeah, that's cool. Thanks. Yeah, I tried to make something for everyone. Even if you don't care to pick up any style advice, you might like the Sweatpant Diaries because it doesn't have any of it and it's just a narrative. Or you might like the photos or you might like the quotes. So hopefully someone can pick out even the smallest little thing and enjoy it.
Right. I think it does that. And with so many different components in here, what message do you want people to get from this book?
I think the message that I really want everyone to get is that style is silly. And that's kind of the best part about it. It doesn't have to be so serious.
Well, I'm sure everyone will enjoy it. And I thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Of course. Thank you.
Grace Helbig's latest book is called Grace and Style, The Art of Pretending You Have It. She's also the star of a YouTube channel called It's Grace. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski earlier this year, and you'll find more information at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then Milwaukee writer Larry Watson shares the story of his latest novel of Montana in the 1960s, As Good as Gone. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. It's an all-books edition of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Of the many archetypes that are out there, maybe one that is most American is that of the cowboy. From Hollywood movies to dime store novels to the Marlboro Man, the image of the cowboy has had an allure for people in this country. And even today, people in other parts of the world sometimes stereotype Americans or American attitudes by using the metaphor of the cowboy.
But it is a more nuanced portrayal of that figure who is at the center of Milwaukee writer Larry Watson's new novel. As Good as Gone is set in Montana, and it tells the story of Calvin Sidey, who has long lived as something of a recluse. Here's Larry Watson reading from the book's opening.
He's watching, Bill Sidey thinks. My father is watching me at this very moment. But Bill can't take his eyes off the road, a steep, twisting, two-track trail that winds down from the top of the butte to the canyon floor. A juniper bush scratches the side of the car, and Bill winces. Something that sounds more solid than weeds scrapes along the undercarriage. But there's nothing Bill can do other than keep the tires in the ruts and feather the brakes to make sure he doesn't lose control on his descent. And sure enough, when the road finally levels off and Bill permits himself a look farther ahead, he sees the figure that he's sure has been there all along. A tall, lean, white-haired man stands in the open doorway of a 20-foot house trailer, his hands jammed in the pockets of his faded Levi's. Calvin Sidey, Bill's father, a hawk with prey in sight, could not watch more intently.
Larry Watson reading the opening to his new novel, As Good as Gone. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, and obviously we're intrigued already. I want to ask you about the forces that led you to shape Calvin and the rest of your characters, honestly. Where did the book begin for you?
Well, it probably began in childhood when I was watching cowboy movies. And Calvin certainly bears some resemblance to some of the heroes in those Western movies. But those were mythic figures. And as appealing as they might have been in many ways, as heroic as they were, I always had a counter to that myth, because my grandfather was a cowboy, and he was nothing like the movie cowboys, and he would have found it laughable if somebody said, "Well, Gus, you're an American icon, you're a cowboy," and he didn't think of his cowboy years as the high point of his life. He thought he was a success when he homesteaded, raised a family, helped start a community, a church, a school, and so I sort of think of him as the anti-Calvin Sidey.
There's a scene a little later on in this book when Calvin has gone to stay with his grandchildren in town, and he's had an interaction with Will, his grandson, and Will goes into the bathroom and tries to practice being Calvin. And I'm wondering, given what you just said, is there a little of you and your grandfather in that scene?
There might have been. There might have been. If I went into the bathroom, I probably wasn't imitating Grandpa Gus, but maybe a character that Randolph Scott played in a movie.
Well, that's what kind of what Will decides,
sure,
is that
sure
he's
he
not really able to capture his grandfather. He's able to capture the movie Cowboys.
That's right, yeah. And I don't know, I can't remember if it's in that scene or another one, that when Calvin tries to disabuse Will of his notions of who and what a cowboy is.
Right, and in fact, the icon of the true cowboy, of course, doesn't really exist today in reality in the way we imagine it. And in fact, Calvin kind of makes the point already in the 1960s that that image of the cowboy wasn't really representative of what being a cowboy was.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think he says that he spends more time digging fence posts and digging holes for fence posts than he does anything else.
Well, and given that, why were the 1960s the right time for this book to play out?
Well, I can remember them. it's the 1960s, just before everything changed, but things were beginning to change. And I think social and cultural change comes to the country in different stages and at different times. It is the 1963 before Kennedy's assassination, because I think that's when things really began to accelerate. But change is afoot, and the civil rights movement has certainly started, and Bob Dylan has released an album, and the Beatles are coming, and it's not going to be Calvin Seide's world anymore.
Even in Montana, where things probably took a little longer to get to.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, sure. I was in North Dakota in the 1960s, and yes, you're right. It took a little longer for things to get there.
As Good as Gone is the title of the book, and just about everyone in it has a reason to want to leave where they are in life.
Oh, that's very good. And sure, I hadn't thought of that before, but maybe there's stayers and leavers in this book. Calvin's son, Bill, is somebody who stays. And Calvin has left a number of times before, and I think he's a notable figure in the community. It's certainly something that he could have traded on, but he chose not to. And I do think that there is something that some people want to be in a community where they are known. Other people would like not to be known. And I think Calvin Seide does not want to be known.
Or doesn't think he wants to be known.
Or doesn't think he wants to be known, exactly.
We don't want to say too much beyond that.
Yeah.
But did you feel a danger in over-romanticizing Calvin Seide a little bit?
Well, I didn't think I'd done much of it, but now the book has been out unofficially, and I've heard from a few readers and seen a few advanced reviews, and I'm a little surprised at how people respond to Calvin Seide. I was in Chicago for Book Expo, and I went to a book event. I talked to a woman who was, I think she had worked at a bookstore in Seattle. And anyway, she'd read the book, and she said, "Oh, I want Calvin Seide to be my father." And I thought, no, you don't. But
it's exactly not the point.
That is exactly not the point. But I do think that there is a longing in this country for someone like Calvin Seide, for one of those knights to come out of nowhere and solve people's problems. And certainly that's something that plays out over and over again in Western movies and television programs. And I think I hope I've pointed out that that's a dangerous thing to long for.
I'm not always one for blurbs, but the word empathy jumps out from the top of the cover of this book above the title. And that's the word I kept coming back to as the pages went by. Characters are doing things. Calvin's doing things. Bill's doing things. The grandchildren are doing things that we might not want them to do at every turn. But you write it in a way that really offers us some empathy for why they're doing it.
I hope that's true. Yeah, I've certainly tried for that in this novel and in my fiction generally. Yes, and often those things are secret things, and problems develop because they don't talk to each other. I think it's another one of those Western myths about the taciturnity of the Westerner, and like a lot of myths and stereotypes, it has some truth to it. If people would talk to each other, the problems that they have would not be nearly as severe as they are.
The book would be a lot shorter, too.
The book would be a lot shorter. The book wouldn't be, probably.
You've lived and worked and written in Wisconsin for on the order of 3 decades.
That's right.
I think. Why does that other part of this country, the it's not exact, I guess it's the American West. It's not the far West, but it is the West. Why does it still hold such a strong pull for you?
Well, because I don't live there. my wife always says that once we leave a place, then it's a fair game for my fiction. It does have some mythic resonances, certainly. It connects with some things from my childhood. I do feel as though I write from memory more than from observation. And I trust my memory that it's a kind of filter, and that the things that stick in the filter, images, characters, gestures, are there for a reason. I may not know what that reason is, but I still find those things useful for fiction.
At the same time, is there still a certain distance in the Montana you portray from the North Dakota in which you grew up?
Sure. But my Gladstone, for example, is a fictional community. My Bent Rock in Montana, 1948, and some other books were fictional communities. And I used made-up communities so that I could use some details from the Montana that I remembered and from the North Dakota community I grew up in. And people wouldn't write me letters and say, oh, you got Glendive wrong, or no, that's not the way the street runs in Billings or something. By the way, they did that anyway. But
this has got to be Dickinson.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. And you have it on the wrong side of the Badlands or something. So I do feel as though it's sort of my territory. I do think that writers are always looking to claim a territory. There are some regions that, of course, I think are forever off limits. I can't imagine what it would be like to be a Southern writer and just to have Faulkner looming over you all the time. But I did feel as though I could sort of make a territorial claim on eastern Montana and western North Dakota.
It may be that there are writers in eastern Montana or western North Dakota who fear they have Larry Watson looming over them.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, they shouldn't be concerned.
What was the most significant way this book changed from the time you conceived of it to what's in front of us right now?
With Kelvin Seide, I struggled with an early draft or some early drafts with this book, and I couldn't quite figure out what the problem was. I knew that something was wrong. I didn't know exactly what it was. The plot and the action was always very close to what it is now, but Kelvin Seide was not a point of view character. So I had people looking at him from the outside, but I didn't have Kelvin Seide's perspective. And once I realized that the novel just couldn't work that way, it sort of came around right.
Was the empathy easier to come by once you had that point of view that Kelvin has?
Yes. And I don't know exactly what it was that gave me access. I got older, maybe. I don't know. But it also made some things in the novel. It also allowed me some dual perspective on some incidents in the novel. So some things that Kelvin Seide does in the book are quite different from his point of view as compared to how other characters see what he's doing.
This novel is number six?
This is number 10.
Number 10. Shows my math skills. Is publication date still exciting for you at novel number 10?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Sure. It will feel strange, of course, because I've finished the book a while ago. So once it goes out into the world, it doesn't feel like mine anymore. I can keep a book in my head as long as I'm working on it. But once I finish it, it goes away. And so I'm always worried that someone's going to ask me a question that I'll draw a blank on. You know, Calvin Seide.
Like that thing that happened on page 47.
That what? What? Yeah. He what?
And at the same time, there must be a certain degree. I mean, the reviewers have had this book for a while, but the readers at large will soon have it in their hands, and that's when the real reaction will come.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to that. I mean, one of the great things about appearing at a bookstore or at a book club or a library is that you get to listen to people talk about, well, your work.
Well, it is definitely one that I hope they'll be talking about. And Larry Watson, thank you so much. Congratulations. And let's talk again soon.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Larry Watson's latest novel is called As Good as Gone. His past books include Let Him Go, Montana 1948, and others. Watson lives in Milwaukee, and he teaches at Marquette University, and we spoke with him back in June, just as the book was coming out. And that's it for our All Books edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Tomorrow on the show, we continue our trip back through the 2016 archives with some of the best interviews we've done about films in the past year.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, though, and I hope you will be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.